But today, I think very importantly, we chose the subject which I think is going to exercise a lot of our minds over the next three or four months, and that is the Strategic Defence and Security Review, which is going to be finished and published later this year. I thought we would try and preempt that by asking three eminent figures from the armed forces in the last few years to come and talk to us about the tough choices for tough times, but also to ask perhaps the cynical question, will we get it right? But I think most of us feel that too often in the past we haven't got it quite right. So you've set a challenging subject, and you'll ask each of them to speak for about 10 minutes, and then we'll open it up to the floor. But I will start by introducing each of them. I've got long biographies, but most of them that you know their biographies, I'll just give you the bare bones. First of all, I'm going to ask the Marshal of the Royal Air Force, the Lord Stirrup, KG, GCB, AFC, to speak first. He was, as you know, Chief of the Air Staff in 2003, and then was appointed Chief of the Defence Staff in 2006. So he's not only seen one service, but he's seen all three services at close quarters. I will then ask General the Lord Dannett, GCB, CBE, MCDL, who was a soldier for 40 years. He ended his military career as Chief of the General Staff, which is the professional head of the British Army. So you'll be able to give us his view on that very important area. And last, but certainly not least, I'm going to call on Admiral the Right Honourable Baron West of Spithead, GCB, DSC, PC, ADC. He's got a long biography, but again, I won't go through it all. What is important is that he was Commander-in-Chief of the Fleet for the invasion of Afghanistan and First Sea Lord for the invasion of Iraq. He then became a minister in the last Labour government, but what he did at the end was to produce the nation's first national security strategy, and he left the government in 2005. So he again will talk to us, not only from the naval, 2010. He will talk to us not only from the naval perspective, but hopefully from the wider strategic angle as well. So I'm going to start without any more ado, and I need to ask the Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Lord Stirrup, to speak to us.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good afternoon, everybody. I've just got a few minutes to kick things off, so clearly I'm not going to indulge in any sort of comprehensive perspective or review of defence or defence requirements. But I will try in those few minutes to register with you what I regard as a few key points. And the first thing I'd say is that whenever we have a defence review, it's always preceded with the debate about whether defence reviews should be foreign policy led or resource driven. The answer, of course, is they have to be both. A strategy is in large part about marrying aims and objectives with resources. So you have to consider both. There's no earthly point in having a foreign policy which you cannot possibly afford to implement. On the other hand, neither is there any sense in being so niggardly with your defence and security that you put the country, its people and its interests at extremely serious risks in a challenging world. So getting that balance right, of course, is in many ways the key judgment in any defence review. A classic example, I think, is that the Prime Minister's recent announcement that he would like to see an emphasis given to special forces and intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance in this defence review. Well, I happen to agree with that, but they were given special consideration and priority in the last defence review. The problem is that if you want to give that priority meaning by enhancing capability, then you have to create headroom elsewhere in the programme, financial headroom to allow you to afford that capability. And that's next to impossible when any financial headroom you can identify is immediately swallowed up in the need to make substantial savings. So getting the balance between the two is absolutely right. Now, in terms of the resource envelope this time round, we have had an announcement from the Prime Minister. He has announced that the UK will adhere to the 2% target of defence spending within NATO until 2020. And that is good news, and I'll come on to some of the reasons for that later on. But, of course, very much depends upon how that actually is measured. And if it were just that alone that was in the announcement, I would be somewhat suspicious because the Treasury are the world's greatest experts at wheeling out ever larger mirrors and smoke generators. And there's already been some debate about what's going to be included and what isn't, and of course, you know, provided it is within the NATO rules and definitions of what should be measured, then I suppose, even though we might moan about it, the accounting dodges, it is in any event legal. But the announcement went further than that and did announce real terms increases above inflation in each of the years. And that, of course, is real money, and that is good news. And so we should be glad about that. If we think, though, that this now means that the defence programme is going to be able to move into broad sunlit uplands, we are deluding ourselves. Because we've had real terms increases in the defence budget before. The fact is that the cost of things goes up, you know, much greater than people anticipate for a whole variety of reasons. We don't know what's going to happen to the pay bill in the future and personnel-related costs. So there will be enormous pressures on the defence budget and the programme as it stands. And we've already seen signs of that. And, of course, if you want to afford new capabilities as well, they will just they will only serve to increase the pressure. So it might seem rather ungrateful of me to say, well, you know, thank you very much for that announcement, but actually we need more. But I say it for two reasons. First of all, because we do need more. And secondly, I don't think that gratitude is the right sort of emotion when a government is doing what one thinks is only its primary duty for its citizens in safeguarding their security and the security of the country. We should be glad, but I don't think we ought to be grateful for it. So it's good news as far as it goes, but we should be realistic and hard-headed about what it actually means. The second point I want to make is that in these sorts of, or after these reviews, in the years succeeding a defence review, people always leap up and say, ah, you didn't foresee that, did you? Got it wrong. You didn't foresee Libya or 9/11 or Syria or ISIL, and all of that's true. You know, the things were not foreseen. But what was foreseen and what was stated very clearly in every defence review, certainly stretching back in my memory, and stated very clearly, is that things will come along that we did not foresee and did not expect, and we have to be able to react to them. So the lesson of events like Libya and ISIL and all the rest is that sentence, that proposition is real. It has meaning in the real world, and we better pay attention to it and conduct ourselves in the review accordingly rather than just inserting it and paying lip service to it. So I think that is an absolutely crucial point to understand. The third point I would make is that this seems to me to be a rather timely SDSR, not just because it's the five-year cycle, a new government and all the rest of it, but because actually the EU is about to embark on its own review of European security strategy. And whatever position one takes with regard to the EU and the euro more generally, it is a fact that we live in Europe, and therefore European security is of fundamental importance to us. And we need to get this right. We need to get this right in the UK, but also more widely within Europe. So we have a real chance here to give a lead and to influence the emerging European security strategy, which I think is very good news. We need to seize that opportunity. Well, with that as background, let me, if I may, just pose some key questions. I make no pretense that these are all-inclusive, that they're comprehensive. In the time available, clearly they're not. But they are some important issues which I think need to be settled during the conduct of this security and defence review. The first is, do we still believe in this country, as we have done for decades, that the transatlantic alliance is essential to our own security? That has been the bedrock of all of our defence policy, essentially since 1945, and indeed one could say from earlier. If it is true, and I personally believe that it is true, then we need to act like we mean it. And there is no doubt that in recent years we haven't acted like we mean it. That doesn't mean to say that we have to fall in with everything that America thinks or suggests, but we have to not just say that the relationship is important, but act as if it is as well. Now, in that sense, the 2% announcement is extremely good news, because, frankly, many of our interlocutors on the other side of the Atlantic, like many of us on this side, simply could not understand how a British Prime Minister could stand up and berate the rest of NATO members about the 2% target and then not commit to it himself. Well, he has committed to it, so that's good. So, you know, in a sense, we put our money where our mouth is there. But we need to go beyond that. We need to reassert ourselves, not just by our words, but by our actions, as one of the leading members of NATO. That's been rather lacking, I think, in recent years, as we became rather introspective about our own financial and economic difficulties. I'm not saying we did nothing, I'm not saying we didn't play our part, but we were not in the leadership role that we've been accustomed to assume, and I think we need to reposition ourselves there and act as if we mean what we say about the transatlantic relationship. The next point I make is, how do we ensure the health and strength of Article 5 within NATO in the 21st century? Clearly, the most proximate problem in this regard is Russia and Ukraine. And, you know, Russia has quite clearly got its own agenda. It's been seeking and is still seeking to weaken the West, more EU and NATO more generally. How has NATO responded to that? Has it been doing the right kind of things? And what should it be doing in the future? I actually think that, albeit rather late in the day, NATO has reacted reasonably well in recent months to the challenge in Ukraine. I think, for example, pre-positioning US armaments in Poland is a pretty heavy and important signal in terms of NATO resolve. There's much more to do there, and here is an area where our leadership in NATO is going to be important. But I think that that is a critical question. And, of course, it's not just about facing, you know, the third shock army across the inner-German border anymore. It's not just pure head-on, force-on-force conflict. It's a much more subtle and difficult issue than that, and we've got to get our minds within NATO around all of those issues. The third point I would raise is, how do we deal with all of the issues that emerge from the nexus of problems and crises in the Middle East and North Africa, many, if not most of which, have their origin in the unravelling of the post-1918 settlement that was intended to tidy up the detritus of the Ottoman and Habsburg empires. One thing we certainly cannot and should not be doing, the next session, is sitting around a table and drawing lines on the map of the Middle East. We're not very good at that. We nearly always get it wrong. It is for the people in the region to decide their future, their political structures and all the rest of it, with international support as appropriate. But what can we do to help them in that and help to ensure that the patterns that emerge throughout that whole process are generally more of the benign kind than of the malign kind? And we see plenty of malign patterns. So there's some very, very tricky, difficult but crucial work to be done within that region. And that's something that we need to prepare ourselves for as this defence review moves forward. And the final point that I'd make is, what do we do to prepare ourselves, to prepare our attitude towards and our responses to towards the emerging situation in the High North? This is something that a number of us have cared about for a long time, but has not been on the radar of many people. But it seems to be undoubtedly the case that before long, we will have an ice-free passage around the north, probably all year round. And that is going to cut off thousands of miles of sailing time between here and the Far East. That's a lot of money. You know, that's a big commercial opportunity. There are also, of course, a great many energy resources up in the High North. That is going to become a geostrategic choke point, an area of considerable importance to us and to Europe more generally, and I don't think we've been paying sufficient attention to that. And this is one opportunity for us to get a bit ahead of the game rather than for waiting for the crises to erupt before we actually take any action. So I think that's another area that I point to, that we need to do some long-term strategic thinking. The question was, will we get it right? Well, of course, it depends upon your definition of right. If by right you mean we'll foresee all the events and crises that will occur over the next 5 years, as I suggested earlier, we most certainly will not. Things will come along that will surprise us, that we did not expect, and we have to be prepared for them. Therefore, whatever emerges from this defence review needs to ensure that we retain our agility and our flexibility and our adaptability, because that's the only way that you are able to respond to those unforeseen crises in an appropriate manner. And that has to play through, of course, into our equipment program, into our procurement, into our systems, but equally, as well as requiring the right investment in infrastructure and systems, it requires talent. It requires huge talent amongst your people. And that, I think, would be my final point. We have a massive challenge here, because defence over the last few years has been seen as somewhat of a declining industry. I think the recent announcement has given it a bit of a fillip, but we are going to face a huge challenge in the military, perhaps not in recruiting, but certainly in retaining the right people and the people with the talent we need. And that is one of the issues that has got to be at the heart of this defence review if we're going to get it right. Thanks very much.
excellent and challenging introduction. I'm now going to ask General Dan to speak to him.
Well, Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, can I first of all say it's a great privilege to follow Lord Stirrup, who did what I hoped he would do, which actually was give us a macro overview of the major issues facing us in the Defence Review, so that myself and Alan Westerfollow perhaps don't have to do that. But I agree almost entirely with everything that has been said so far in the session. I think the other point which we ought to bear in mind, and we now rather take it as a given, is that we are having an SDSR. We had one in 2010, we're having one in 2015. But prior to 2010, we had not had a proper SDR since 1997, 1998. And it was a really important move of the last government, the coalition government, to decide that once in every parliament there would be a defence review. I think it's really important to have that discipline. And we're almost taking it for granted that there is one. And I think it's terribly important that we are doing so. Having listened with approval to the macro issues that Lord Stirrup set out, what I'd like to do for a few minutes is perhaps bring it down a level and look at some of those issues from the perspective of the Army, of our land forces, perhaps inevitably given the responsibilities which I had until 2009. That said, pretty obviously the purpose and grand strategic objective of our land forces, of the Army, is to be fully capable of playing our part in confronting the challenges that we face at the present moment, first and foremost of which is the challenge from Islamic State and the requirement to meet the coalition's objective of defeating Islamic State and all the ramifications that follow from that. And we can go back into that in greater detail. But there's no discretion about that. The objective of defeating and on the way discrediting Islamic State is critically important. And secondly, behind that is the threat from a more aggressive and assertive Russia, deterring whatever Vladimir Putin might think that he wants to do or do next. And then, of course, there's the range of other threats which arise from the Middle East, migration and other issues. So that's the grand strategic objective, that the Army must be capable of playing its part to fulfil that part of our national grand strategic objective. Coming down to the military strategic objective, as far as the Army is concerned, coming out of this defence review, the primary requirement is to make sure that Force 2020, Army 2020 within Force 2020, as set out from the 2010 Defence Review, is fully implemented. There was a real concern until we had the three pledges made by the Prime Minister during the election campaign, and more recently the commitment to the headline of 2% of GDP on defence, that there would be a whittling away of the defence budget and therefore an unravelling of Force 2020 and Army 2020. If that had been the case, then a lot of work has been done over the last 3 or 4 years. We would have to have started again. So there is some confidence that we could move towards fulfilling Force 2020 and Army 2020. And if we can do that, that would be a very achievable and commendable outcome from this SDSR. Why is this particularly important for the Army? It's for these headline reasons. In 2010, the SDSR took some 7 to 8% out of the defence budget. That translated, amongst other things, to a 20% reduction in the regular manpower of the Army, and that translated into a reduction by 50% of what the Army could do. What do I mean? Just very simply this. In 2006 to 2009, when we were engaged in significant size operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, from the size of our land forces, I include Royal Marines, RAF Regiment, Helicopter Command and elements such as that, we were able to generate 5 brigade groups to go around a cycle in Afghanistan and 5 brigade groups to go around a cycle in Iraq. That's 10 brigade groups, 5 and 5, out of an army and Royal Marines that actually had 8. The mass was large enough to be able to generate more to achieve the outcome that the government of the day required. Under Army 2020 and Force 2020, we could only do one of those operations with 5 brigades going around a cycle. So for a 7 or 8% cut in the money, it led to a 20% cut in the regular manpower, which has led to a 50% cut in the potential outcome of what our land forces can do. And therefore, it's critically important to make sure we've got a credible capability to meet those grand strategic objectives, that we can at least do one of those major operations if it arose again, and of course we're into the if question, but to do it again and do it properly. Beneath that, there are quite a number of operational and tactical issues which are significant, but if we don't get those right, then we won't be able to achieve the fulfilment of Army 2020 and Force 2020 that I talked about within the overall objective that I've already mentioned. What are some of those things? We must keep a capability to deploy our land forces at up to divisional level. Why is that important? It's only at the divisional level, or the divisional level is the lowest level, that all elements of land combat power can be integrated together. Below that level, we're dealing with large tactical units that have essentially lost their meaning in a modern conventional manoeuvre army. That's important in its own right. It's important as a focus for training and motivation. It's also very important in terms of our relationship with the United States. If in a future major conflict, I don't know where, don't know when, but it'll happen somewhere along the line, if we're not able as the UK to put a division into the field, we drop off the top table and we're straight down amongst the smaller players. And when you're down amongst the smaller players, you have virtually no influence on the overall objective, on the overall plan at all. We may have felt we didn't have much influence in the First Gulf War or the Second Gulf War, but by fielding a division within the overall American-led scheme of manoeuvre, we had some influence. And it's important that the Americans can count on us to be able to do that. So it's important in its own right. It's also important in terms of our relationship with the Americans and being a dependable and capable ally. Underpinning all that is the notion about the reserves. It seemed like a pretty comfortable, quick fix shortly after the 2010 SDSR came out, that the regular army, having reduced to 82,000 and the other services suffering also reductions, that it was going to be all right because we'd have 30,000 trained reservists. That has proved to be a huge challenge. I think the corner has been turned and numbers are increasing, and it's important that they do increase. But actually, it's not as important as perhaps it seemed. If you accept, in land forces terms, that what the army can do is what it can generate from its regular force of 82,000, that's realistic. The 30,000, up to 30,000 reservists must be regarded genuinely as a reserve and not part of the plan. It's a reserve that can be mobilised in terms of national extremists. And I think if we think of it that way, then actually getting towards 30,000 is a good thing, but if we don't achieve it, it's not a disaster. What the army and the land forces can do comes out of that envelope of 82,000. Then there's the issue of bringing our forces back from Germany. It's something that I argued for strongly while I was Chief of the General Staff. It didn't seem to have much logic to retain 20,000 troops 70 years after the end of the Second World War, 20-odd years after the Cold War in Germany. It was expensive. And when money is tight, it made financial sense to bring those elements of the army back to the UK. And that is the plan, to do that by 2020. But will it be affordable? I'm not sure that it will be affordable. If it's not affordable, and there are environmental reasons against putting all our armoured troops around Salisbury Plain, for that environmental reason and that affordability reason, actually you could argue a very good case that to leave one brigade group in Germany plays quite sensibly in these changed circumstances between 2010 and 2015 to actually say that we are making something of a statement by keeping a presence in Europe. Of course, a brigade in Sennelager and Paderborn is not going to make a material difference to Vladimir Putin's thinking, but it sends part of the message that we need to send. So what we do about Germany, I think, is a very critical issue. Time moves on. What we've also got to watch, and this does come back to the 2% announcement, is that 2% really means 2%, and there isn't constructive accounting within that. And the way that we'll know that we're becoming victims of constructive accounting is when the cash for day-to-day business drops off. And this will affect our land forces in particular, but also the Navy and the Royal Air Force in terms of activity levels. If there isn't sufficient resource on an annual basis to conduct overseas exercises, to conduct training, to have the fuel for ships, the fuel for aircraft to fly, then our training standards and our capability will drop off. but critically, the motivation and morale of our people will drop off. And when that happens, the exit starts to get very popular and our numbers will begin to drop. So we've got to make sure that the spend is a genuine spend at 2%, not the least of which reason to keep activity levels up, to keep our training levels up, our expertise levels up, and also our motivation. And I think finally, there are some equipment issues that have got to be looked at. The particular issue that affects our land forces, and I think Alan West and Jock Stewart will probably know where I'm going to go on this, is the Army has had an articulated requirement to replace its medium-weight vehicles. It's been there for quite some time. The cash was not there in the middle of the last decade. It went on to other things. And the medium-weight vehicle replacement program was effectively zero-funded, apart from just the Scout Reconnaissance Vehicle that's coming in small numbers. But brigades that we might deploy on operations today, their infantry battalions in the main are equipped with what we've salvaged from Afghanistan and Iraq. Vehicles procured through the urgent operational requirement process for those particular theatres. Good in those theatres and save a lot of lives. But will they be the right kind of vehicles on a modern manoeuvre battlefield? Probably not. There is a major capability gap that the Army has got if it's going to be capable of manoeuvre in the 21st century. And we've got to address this issue of a medium-weight vehicle replacement programme. So there we are. Will we get it right? I hope so. The Army must remain capable in order to meet our grand strategic objectives. There are a number of things that we've got to focus on in order to be able to do that. Let's hope that the 2% means 2% and that we can do most of the things that I've talked about, but I think we have to keep an open mind.
Thank you very much.
It's always a delight to follow Richard. I have great respect for military officers and the way they do business. Wellington, famously, when he was Prime Minister in 1828, went to his first cabinet meeting and quoted to his private secretary on coming out, "An extraordinary affair. I gave them their orders and they wanted to stay and discuss them." So, anyway. Most wars, as we know, and have been touched on by the two previous speakers, catch us by surprise. And the reality, I believe, is that a nation such as ours has to maintain a general set of warfighting capabilities at a certain scale or become an irrelevance in world affairs, with a corresponding fall in our wealth and our ability to shape world events to our advantage. And we're able to do that through the P5, all sorts of areas, and we can do it if we have some hard power. Additionally, for the first time since the end of World War II, America is facing relative military decline. It is exacerbated, I believe, by Europe's, and most notably our, retreat from strategic engagement. And that is something I believe we have seen over the last few years. America will need allies with capable militaries if her leadership of a liberal, rules-based world is to continue, and I believe it's in our interest as a nation that it should. I think it's instructive to reflect on the managed decline of our hard power capability since World War II. There have been 9 defence reviews in that period. And there are constant themes that arise again and again, and successive governments have actually ignored them very often. I would like to think that SDSR 2015 will be different, but I'm not over hopeful. And certainly we do not have a good track record as governments of continuing to fund satisfactorily the decisions that are made in reviews. Clearly there's a relationship between the economy and defence, as has been stated. A strong economy is vital, even when engaged in a war for survival. Duncan Sands, in his 1957 review, said that without a strong economy, military power cannot in the long run be supported, and that military expenditure should be considered in conjunction with the need to maintain the country's financial and economic strength. Absolutely right, and that's a theme that's run through all our defence reviews, because it's very understandable. It is of interest to note, when he was saying that, that actually defence was 10% of our GDP. The economic imperatives are crucial, but today we are the 5th richest nation in the world, and military capability is not a matter solely of other budgeting priorities or of financial hardship. Decline is a choice, and it's not a choice, I believe, that we as a nation should make. The Sands Review saw nuclear deterrence as the mainstay of our defence policy. He stated that European allies should shoulder more of the conventional burden within NATO. That rings a bell, doesn't it? It emphasised the need for aircraft carriers to effectively bring power around the world, And it also said that governments should not overcommit politically and operate outside planning assumptions, even for short periods of time. And I have to say that again is a theme, and I'm afraid governments do and regularly do exactly that. They say we're only going to do these things, and they do a lot more, and they want to do a lot more. They like to stride the globe and say they're going to do things. The Healy reviews between 65 and 68 favoured conventional rather than nuclear, and it said in there, and I'll read this because it's important, the present government has inherited defence forces which are seriously overstretched and in some respects dangerously under-equipped. There has been no real attempt to match political commitments to military resources, still less to relate the resources made available for defence to economic circumstances of the nation. That rings a bell, doesn't it? You could actually slot that into most of the reviews we've done. The main thrust of his review was cancellation of further aircraft carriers, halving the Territorial Army, withdrawal from east of Suez. Mason, in 1975 review, said, "Our examination of the impact of cuts to defence has convinced us as a government that force reductions resulting from a defence review may overstretch the services in fulfilment of their remaining commitments and may leave an inadequate margin for dealing with unforeseen tasks." Absolutely true, and it happens again and again. The Knott Review of 81 decided to proceed with the replacement of the Terrant, going down the Trident route, and concluded that cost savings could most easily be achieved by making a strategic choice between either the UK's continental or maritime contribution to NATO, forgetting all our other commitments in the world. The Falklands War showed the folly of that decision, and we didn't seem to learn the lessons of that, of not being able to predict, because we constantly tell governments the unpredictable is the only thing that's going to happen, but they don't really hoist it in. And in Options for Change, Tom King demanded savings and a reduction in the share of GDP taken by defence. Sure enough, spending fell to 4.3% from 5.2%, quite a big drop in that year. There followed the Gulf War, civil war in former Yugoslavia. As I say, one can't help feeling that the assumptions were flawed, and governments never seem to learn, no matter how much the military tells them, that you cannot predict what is going to happen, and that means you have to have some overall capability. Labour, when it entered office in 1997, conducted a foreign policy-led review to reassess UK's national interests and its commitments. It had two main themes, SDR 1997, which emerged from it: the need to move to rapidly deployable expeditionary forces, hence the two big carriers, and the need for more joinery. The conclusions of the SDR were welcomed. People thought this was a good review, and it was a good review. But crucially, the planned programme was not fully funded in subsequent years. And again, that is a real problem, has been a problem. So to SDSR 2010, which I fear had forgotten many of the themes of the past and has to be seen largely as a cuts-driven exercise, it has been lambasted by an awful lot of people. And since 2010, we have seen a 9.5% reduction in defence spending, a 30% reduction in military capability. This capability leverage is exactly what General Dannett was talking about. It's much more than you would think from the amount of money that is reduced. It bore little relationship or thoughts of all the various threats there might be that we couldn't predict, because we can't predict them. But it's interesting, in terms of percentage of GDP spent on defence, we only dropped 0.2% in the whole 13 years before 2010, but we actually dropped more than double that in the 5 years up to now. We're now at about 2.1%, or is it 2.2%, and the previous speakers have spoken on this. I am very, very concerned what exactly the 2% figure means. I've asked a number of questions in the House. I've got a number of written questions. I've not had a satisfactory answer. And I think it needs real clarification. It needs real clarification. The 2015 Strategic Defence Review must be based on the National Security Strategy and the National Risk Assessment. Now, those two things, I think, can be done without actually looking at resource constraints. But they have to articulate where we see the UK's place in the world. It should lay out all the various risks. But the SDSR has to lay out stark choices, and ministers must explain what risks they're prepared to take with our security as a result of the inevitable resource constraints, because the SDSR has to apply resource constraints, as Jock stated. It absolutely has to take those into account. And what are the implications of the risks that ministers are going to take? Because too often they don't tell us what the implications are of the risks they intend to take because of the lack of money for it. Any further cuts to defence, I believe, will have a devastating impact on our nation's security. The government have got to ensure that the commitment to NATO's 2% as a minimum spent on defence should result in growth rather than further reductions. And I'm not convinced there's going to be very much extra money. And actually, the chiefs of staff and a lot of people in the MOD can't work out exactly what sort of extra money there will really be, what real money there will be. And we need to have some real clarity about that. I think the whole base of the SDR needs a fundamental rethink of priorities within government and across Whitehall departments. Can we really expect to remain a member of the UN Security Council with our ever diminishing military capability? Can we protect our 14 dependencies? Can we protect global shipping? Can we ensure the safety of UK nationals, national interests? All these things are at risk. We have a political class that has little military experience, and if ministers get defence wrong, and they need to be clear of this, the nation will never forgive them, and the cost in blood and treasure are enormous. It could be argued that the removal of Endurance from her role in the South Atlantic in 81 for the saving of £16 million, and lots of people were against it, triggered the invasion of the Falklands with a final cost of almost 300 dead British people and £6 billion. Strong defence prevents war. But the government has boxed itself into a corner, too much ring-fenced, too many commitments. According to press reports, and it was touched on by Jock, the Prime Minister wants defence forces consisting of drones and special forces and reconnaissance capability. Clearly all of these are very crucial, and we've identified them in the past. But I don't think that will answer all the inevitable unforeseen threats that can come up and that we can promise you will affect us. And I have to say I found it slightly surprising he was saying that, bearing in mind we have a national security strategy going on, we have an NRA going on, and he seemed to be rather, in military terms, situating the appreciation by making that statement when he did. In terms of dream sheets, I'm sure I'm allowed to give a dream sheet, aren't I, as a maritime chap, what sorts of things I'd like to see. Well, I think the first thing on the nuclear side, the Vanguard class, I would love to see the government actually take this to Parliament this autumn and get it done, agreed and through. It's about time we got cracking on it. We need to do that. I'm very concerned with the fragility of all of our nuclear capability, whether it's AWE, whether it's Rolls-Royce in Derby, or whether it's Barrow, and we need to look at that, and it probably needs some money to sort it out. We do need to further develop ISTAR assets. I particularly would like them to be able to deploy from the new carriers to give that global reach. Running both the carriers is, I think, very sound judgment, but the Royal Navy needs an uplift in terms of money for the people to do that. If you just tell them to find it, it's a cut, effectively, for the Navy, and it needs to do that. The Type 45s, to develop their potential, I think we ought to look at ballistic missile defence. I believe that could be crucial in the future, and it is capable of that sort of thing, and I'd like to see CEC on there and land attack missiles. There's no doubt the lack of long-range rapid ocean ASW capability with the loss of the Nimrod is grave, but I'm not sure we can afford the P-8 option. The costs involved, for example, of getting the P-8s would be equivalent to two fast jet squadrons, and the RAF have few enough of those already. Perhaps a mix of drones, satellites, low-tech fixed-wing aircraft, ships, submarines might be a more cost-effective solution, not the optimum, but more cost-effective. We must order the new frigates. All we've done is long lead for three of them. We've got to get the order going. We've got to get our industry building these things. Spending on cyber is crucial, yes, but it's not a panacea. Lots of people think, and you can see people in the Treasury, cyber, that's it, this is the answer, it costs very little, you know, we'll be able to hack the whole world in that sort of problem. That is just not the case. And similarly with special forces, it's great having lots of special forces, but you need a pool to draw them from. Most come from the Royal Marines and the Parachute Regiment. You need lots of soldiers to get to distill those special forces. And my final plea would be, don't forget attrition, please, because we have. When you fight, you lose things. Numbers do count. And I think the Treasury need to have a more realistic view of the value of defence industry and the fact that actually if you buy something in this country, work out the full cost of it compared with abroad, because it seems attractive to the MOD, but it's not necessarily, it's probably cheaper to the nation. So those are a few of my dream sheet things, but I have to say I'm not particularly sanguine that most of them will be met.